Okay, so in the overall brains program so far, we've heard a lot about optimality, various facets of optimality. We've heard about optimality in sensory coding, in motor reaching and motor movements, in behavioral planning, behavioral decision making. So sort of the common theme of this conference has been optimality. But an important aspect of optimality, an important thing that lets optimality be, is learning and adaptation, because optimality helps you, this is really loud, because optimality can help you, learning can help you actually adapt to new inputs or changing inputs. And so you can position yourself to continue to be optimal even in the face of, you know, changing external environments or internal states and so on. So learning is this this thing that we haven't talked about too much. So how do we get? It's more the how of optimality rather than the what. So my talk's going to be on learning and specifically synaptic theories of learning that let you be optimal in certain senses, which I'll describe. So for the purposes of my talk, it's convenient to break up learning in sort of these two categories. So the first category you can think of in learning is learning association amongst events and amongst reinforcements. So for example, if there are events and reinforcements in the outside world and you learn associations between them, that would be the first category. So an example of that kind of learning is classical conditioning, where you just sit there and a stream of the world comes at you and you learn associations between the things that happen in the world. There's a second kind of learning that we do, and that's the one that I'm going to be more focused on in this talk, and that is how do one's own actions affect events and reinforcements from the world, and how do you shape those actions, you know, in a way to change what kind of reinforcements you're going to receive. So this is the kind of learning that I'm more interested in, and in psychology literature, this is an example of this is instrumental conditioning. So instrumental conditioning is where, based on some reinforcements given to you, you have to change your behavior and adapt your behaviors. And the experimenter, for example, would only give you reinforcements based on your actions. So if you do a certain set of actions, you're reinforced. If you don't do a certain set of actions, you're not reinforced. So it's a contingent on your own behavior. So this is the kind of learning I'm interested in, and I'll talk more about. So the question is the following. So in classical conditioning, on a behavioral level, have wondered in 1940s, what could the neural basis of classical conditioning be? And he came up with this proposal that was quite provocative, and you know, people have worked on it in great detail, both theoretically and experimentally, and what he proposes is known as Hebbian learning. So it's just association between two things that occur coincidentally. So sort of there's a rule of a neural basis for some forms of classical conditioning that people feel that they understand somewhat well, if not, you know, very well. But on the other side, so if you look at instrumental conditioning, we don't have very much idea of what the neural basis for that may be. So yeah, I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. So instrumental conditioning, just on a psychology level, is you receive reinforcements contingent on certain actions, and you have to change your actions to change the reinforcements you receive. And I'll tell you more about it right now.
Well,
classical is not contingent on your actions. So classical conditioning, an example, is like Pavlov conditioning, where the dog hears a tone and then receives food, and it's completely independent of what the dog does. It doesn't depend on his behavior. But an example of instrumental conditioning would be a rat has to press a lever when it hears the light, and only then will it receive food. So it has to learn to press to receive. So it's contingent. All right, so I'll describe more what instrumental conditioning is. So just to sort of get a framework for the talk, the outline's going to be, I'll describe this kind of learning, learning with reinforcements as an optimization problem. I'll describe a synaptic learning rule that can actually accomplish this kind of optimization. In spiking networks of neurons with the conductances and so on. I'll describe what the scale-up problem is with this learning rule. Can this learning rule scale up to very large networks that, you know, are like our brain? I'll give you a concrete example, because to deal with the scale-up problem in a nonlinear network, analytics only take you so far. So I'll describe an example of birdsong learning, where we can use both analytical techniques and numerical techniques to find out how long learning will take in actually a large network. And maybe if there's some time, discuss some implications. And all this work is done with Sebastian Sohn. Okay, so more about instrumental conditioning. So to describe instrumental conditioning, I'm going to go back to a really old example. One of the first examples, sort of the father of the field of instrumental learning. And the guy was Thorndike. So in the late 1800s, Thorndike did a series of experiments. And the experiments were the following. So he would take cats, here's a Siamese cat, and he put it in these boxes. And the cat didn't really know what was going on, except cats don't like to be in very small confined spaces. So that's one thing they sort of don't like. So they were in this confined space, and the only way they could actually escape was by simultaneously had to pull a string, step on a platform, and turn one of two latches on the front door, right? And since you can't talk to a cat, it's hard to tell them what they need to do to get out. So the cats just sort of have to figure it out. But if they do manage to get out, then what he would do, he would give them a food reward. And then after, you know, a fairly long interval, he would put them back in the boxes again so they could repeat what they were doing. So what happened? So what were the reinforcements? Okay, so the reinforcements in this case were, A, there was a negative reinforcement, which is the cat didn't like being in the box, so it already had an incentive to leave. And then the other reinforcement was a positive one where, you know, he would get food when he escaped. So that was a good thing, too. So the cat, just based on its desire to not be in a confined space and desire to get some food, started doing the following thing. So Thorndike plotted the amount of time after he put the cat in the box that it needed to escape as a function of the trial number. All right, uh-huh.
It seems very short.
Mm. What seemed short?
Those times seem very short.
I can't comment, I know. Yeah, it's...
It depends enormously on the details, how big the string is,
What the latch is like and so on, yeah. So I can't comment on the absolute number, but what I want you to actually get out of this,
I wouldn't figure it out.
You probably wouldn't figure it out. Well, you probably like clank everything, and I guess the ordering doesn't matter. It's just you just have to do all of them, right? So if you have ordering, then it becomes more complicated because then you have comments.
Yeah, that's
okay. So I guess they all have to be done. You're right. They don't have to be done simultaneously, but they have to all be activated, I guess, for it to work.
I thought you had to stand on the platform and do the other thing all at once.
So you have to sit on the platform and then pull and then so on. Okay. So maybe you're probably right. That's probably what makes it faster. Okay. So Randy and Chuck are probably much bigger experts in these experiments than I could do.
The times and all, no one's making that fast like that.
Really depend on the details.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm not talking about the absolute time. What I want you to get out of this figure is the trend. So what you see is, you know, initially on average, the cat takes, you know, a fair amount of time, order 200 seconds to escape. And by a large number of trials, or some number of trials, maybe not very large, it's actually doing pretty well. And it's escaping in, 30 seconds or something like that. So it seems to be actually improving its behavior, getting out faster and faster, but it's also very variable, the amount of time that it takes to get out. So how do you summarize this? You say that the cat seems to try a bunch of different strategies, multiple strategies, but sort of in a consistent way, it modifies its behavior in a way that tends to improve the average reinforcement. So why does this improve reinforcement? Because if it gets out sooner and sooner, it means it's getting rewarded more and more. And it's getting punished less and less it's spending less and less time in the box. So the strategy of the animal seems to be to just improve its reinforcement by modifying its behavior. So to say it in Thorndike's own words, he coined the law of effect, which is, of several responses made to the same situation, those which are accompanied or closely followed by satisfaction will become more likely to recur. Those accompanied or followed by discomfort to the animal will, other things being equal, have the connections to the situation weakened so that when it recurs, they will be less likely to occur. So the animal's trying many different things, and then it correlates what it did with reward, and the things that have bigger reward, it tends to do more of. All right. So one thing I wanted to sort of just emphasize is that the cat, the animal, as you guys already noticed, is learning some pretty complex things with the help of very little guidance, right? There's not very much guidance in the form of someone telling it what to do, right? It's just driven by, you know, a reward or a reinforcement. So this is just a cute picture of a squirrel. You know, the squirrel manages, in at least the state of Michigan, where my parents live and where I did my undergrad, to always raid birds' nests, bird feeders. And they're not really told how and what specific actions will improve their chances of getting to the bird feeder, but they try many things and ultimately they're paid. It pays off if it works. They get to eat the seeds. So just the main point is that the instruction to receive is not instruction, it's more like an evaluation signal. So with just a very meager form of feedback, they're able to learn a lot. So just the summary slide then for the behavioral work, what animals seem to do is trial, reward, and optimization. So, you know, the dog tries various things. When he brings your slipper, you reward it. And over time, it optimizes its reward because it realizes that if you bring both slippers, then if he brings both slippers, it'll get reward. So I just thought of something absurd. Yeah, it's a squid. He's bringing a giant squid, you know? You don't want a giant squid, so you don't reward it. Messy, too. And so, okay, so then, so you can think of learning in these situations, so learning difficult behaviors as optimization of reward, if reward quantifies your performance in the task. All right, so back to this figure again. So now you know what instrumental conditioning, what I mean by that, and question is, what is the neural basis or synaptic basis that would allow you to do this kind of instrumental conditioning? All right, so question is, since this kind of learning depends on reinforcements and rewards, I framed the question as a optimization question of reinforcement and reward. Question is, what are the neural mechanisms for signaling, you know, global forms of evaluation or reward? So in this is a picture of a single neuron. It's the 1x1 neuron. This is a neuron in the honeybee and in other insects. And this is a single identified neuron, and it projects very widely. This is its whole axonal arbor that you see here. And it projects widely to the mushroom bodies of the insect. And it's very important for olfactory learning. So you can substitute the firing of the 1x1 neuron for the unconditioned stimulus, so for sugar. Instead of giving the animal, the bee sugar, you can stimulate this neuron and use that as the reinforcer for conditioning experiments. So here's an example, therefore, of, you know, signals in the brain that actually communicate to very large areas something about external rewards. Okay, and slightly higher up, there's the dopamine system. While it's hard to say that dopamine is doing this or that, it certainly is some kind of an evaluative signal that's broadcast very widely to many parts of the brain and seems to be important for some forms of learning. So this is just by way of example that the brain also has internal signals that signal reinforcement or rewards. So the question for the neural basis of learning is, how does the brain integrate things like global signals like reward or motor error or something like that with very local signals at the level of single neurons, like their activity, their voltage, their calcium influx, and integrate those two signals to drive synaptic plasticity? So up till now, the sort of interaction, both experimentally and theoretically, between global and local signals is relatively unknown.
So it seems like, you know, getting the reward is definitely part of it, important. But this other part, which is how do you kind of search for the behaviors that give you the reward, that's distinct. Right?
That's right, exactly. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to say, given a reward signal, and given a reward signal, how does the brain move to actually optimize that? So that's the question I'm going to ask, exactly. And that's the thing I'm talking about. And as you point out very correctly, the question of how the brain computes rewards or spreads a signal is a separate question, and it's not a question I'm dealing with. It's a very interesting question, and people think about it, but it's not the focus of this talk. Okay, so if you might say, well, you know, since I already have the signal in the brain telling me how I'm doing, why is this a hard problem, right? What's deep about it, or what's interesting about it? Maybe it's not deep anyway, but what's interesting about it? And I guess some of you already have an intuition that would be hard, but just, you know, to give you an example of how, you know, learning, even if you have a reward signal, it's non-trivial, here's a very simple toy example, okay? So it's a set of four neurons. Arranged in the following way. So these bars are excitatory connections, and that's an inhibitory connection. All right, and I've just set it up so that the firing of this neuron is reward. So this is by fiat. And the question I ask you then, or the brain must ask itself, is should this synapse be strengthened or weakened to increase reward? All right, so the synapse has to wonder that. And it's hard for the synapse to derive knowledge about what, how its activity influences reward for the following reason, because this depends. If you strengthen this, well, it's going to increase the firing of that. But the question is whether this guy is doing inhibition or excitation of the reward. So whether to strengthen or weaken the synapse depends on whether the overall inhibitory pathway is stronger or weaker than the overall excitatory pathway. All right? And so, and not only that, but the relative strengths of these two pathways, the excitatory one and the inhibitory one, actually could change with learning. They change with experience and with learning. So it means that whether the synapse should go up or down really depends on the identity of downstream connections and also on the relative sizes. So it's a very complicated problem, even in a set of very, you know, four simply connected neurons. So this is why the question, you know, may not be obvious. All right, so now we come to our proposal for learning. So our sort of whole framework for the learning rule depends on three modules. So we assume that the brain has, the system that's doing the learning has three components. There's a network, which is a performer. It's what produces behaviors. All right, so its outputs produce outputs, you know, actions or other things. And in addition, there's another brain area that's called the experimenter. The job of the experimenter is to try different strategies, to drive the performer to try different strategies. And in addition, then there's an evaluator. So this area, evaluator just assesses the outputs until it gives you a score. So it's a very non-instructive, sort of a good or bad score. So this is the basic framework in a box setting. So on a neural level, what does it translate to? So here again are the three areas. There's experimenter up there, evaluator, and evaluator there, and this is the performer. All right, so if we zoom in on a single neuron here in the performer, the question is, what is the rule for synaptic change in this performer network that will optimize my reward from the evaluator? What can I do? So this is the prescription. So let me tell you first in spikes and explain why this makes any sense. So if you look at this single neuron here, all right, this neuron is receiving an input from the experimenter, a bunch of inputs from just the performer network itself, and an evaluator input. Right, the evaluation is global, but each neuron in the performer is assumed to receive its own independent perturbation from the experimenter. All right, so the rule is the following. Huh? Oh, okay, so I can tell you more details later, but yes, to first order, actually the inputs should be spatially uncorrelated. And temporally, small autocorrelations are allowed in the input, but they should be small. Okay, so... Okay, so to do an arbitrary task with arbitrary, so if every single neuron in the performer needs to be doing a completely independent thing, completely, so if it's some kind of combinatorial code and each one is completely independent, then you need independent experimenter inputs. But if, for example, the performer is grouped into sets of neurons that all project to the same downstream neuron and they're doing the same thing, then they can actually receive correlated inputs. In fact, it makes it faster, it's better. But the reason you need independent inputs is if I just take this one network and I want it to perform an arbitrary task. So each time the task can depend arbitrarily on individual activities of individual neurons. For that reason, I need the independence condition to prove for arbitrary tasks. But you're right. So for any given task, there can be correlations in the perturbations. Okay, so let me describe the learning rule first before we discuss, you know, why all this independence is important. I think you'll see better. So first, what is the learning rule? So as an experimenter, I would put it this way, the learning rule. So I would say if, so let's call this one of these synapses P. So if there's activity in P in the performer, so this is a performer synapse, that's coincident with an experimental input, an empirical input from the experimental area, and if that's followed shortly after by reward, then the weight, this synaptic weight should be increased. All right? If there's an input in the performer network that's not simultaneous with an input from the empiric synapse, then and that's followed by reward, then the weight should be weakened. All right. So what's the intuition? So the intuition is the following. So there's a single neuron sitting here, right? This neuron. All right. It receives inputs, and then if it receives an experimental input, an empiric input, that makes it fire more than it would just based on its regular inputs alone. So if firing more, if that is followed by reward, it means that was a good thing for it to fire more. right? And that means, how do I consolidate that in all future trials? The way I consolidate that is by saying, if I fired more because of this experimental input and that correlated with the reward, then I should increase the strength of all the synapses that were active at that time, at the moment the experimental input came in. Because that strengthens my drive to that neuron, that strengthens the drive to the neuron at that time, T, and doesn't strengthen at other times, and consolidates the effects of that pulse. Conversely, if the failure to have an experimental input leads to good to reward, then you should actually weaken the inputs coming into the neuron at that time.
Yeah. So
no, no, you don't, you only, the synapses to be learned are always in the performer network, so you always weaken the performance synapses.
I guess I don't understand that. If
yes.
The performer gets something right,
yes.
Is that neuron fire when you got a reward?
Well, it's not the performer doing it right. The performer is more active than average, and if it receives reward, then its input should be strengthened. So if its inputs, if a performer neuron is more active than it would have been due to its regular inputs alone, right? And if that's the, you know, so if a performing neuron is more active than it would have been due to its regular inputs alone, and if that correlates with reward, then you should increase the strength of its inputs, of its regular inputs.
Yeah. The converse case, it seems to me, so the experimenter is like your model of what the performance should be.
No. Experimenter has no model. So think of it this way. Think of the performer. The performer on average is giving rise to some reward. The experimenter is just doing perturbations around it. It sometimes makes it more active at time t0 or less active. So actually, if you think this is actually supposed to be a pulse minus the baseline activation of the experimenter. So if there is a pulse, it means that this experimenter is injecting more than average input at that moment into the neuron. If there's no pulse, it means it's injecting less than average input, because the average input includes, you know, a few pulses once in a while. So if the experimenter is putting in less than average input, then you should weaken your thing. And the mathematical statement will make it clear why there's a subtraction. That's right. So the experimenter is basically a source of noise. It's just a source of perturbations. So it's small perturbations around what the performer is doing anyway. That's correct. So the performer is doing something on average, and the experimenter is just perturbing it a little bit. And then you correlate those perturbations with the reward to decide what to do for in future.
Take the experimenter away.
Yes.
Then all the synapses would unlearn.
So that's not true, because if you take the experimenter away, then the average input from the experimenter is zero, as is the, you know, input at any instant. So it's always input minus average input, so it'll be zero minus zero. So I'll show you in the mathematical statement, I can show you what it is. But basically, the rule is, if performer comes in simultaneously with greater than average input from the experimenter, then you should increase. If it comes in simultaneously with lower than average input from the experimenter, you should decrease. And since average, if you lesion the experimenter, is zero, then it'll be zero. So there'll be maybe some transient period where you don't realize yet that the average input is zero, but presumably this neuron keeps track of what the average input, you need to keep track of what the average input is. If the average input goes to zero, the whole learning goes to zero, so it stays fixed. So that's a very nice feature of the rule, which is if you lesion the experimenter, then the state of the network stays exactly where it was before. There's no unlearning, but there's no more learning.
Because presumably you want to turn the experimenter off once you learn something.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So you can do that by the experimenter, just the activity just going down to zero, and then gradually, and the learning will stop learning or unlearning. Okay, so this was sort of the intuition. So if everyone is sort of with me on the intuition, then we can go to...
How does the blue neuron keep track of what the experimenter's average output is?
Ah, okay, that's a good point. So that's an assumption, right? So the way you could imagine a neuron doing that would be that if the experimenter inputs are spatially segregated from all the other inputs onto the neuron. So for example, or if the chemical identity of the experimenter input is different from the chemical identity of all the other synapses.
Right.
So it's just a low-pass filter. You just do a time average.
But the experimenter doesn't give the same output every single time.
That's correct, that's right.
And so, but then, any particular blue neuron has to know what the experimenter is doing to all the neurons.
No, that's right. So that's not true because, no, so, okay, so the first question was the experimenter input is changing, but we're imagining the experimenter input, for example, could be like a Poisson firing rate, Poisson firing with a fixed rate, right? So then the average input would be the rate of the Poisson process, and each neuron only needs to compute the average input from the noise that it receives, only it. It doesn't need to know. So this neuron could be receiving a Poisson process with a different rate from that neuron and from that neuron, and none of them needs to know what the other is seeing. So it's totally local. So each neuron only needs to know locally in the recent past what inputs has this experimental synapse given it, and what is it giving it right now. And each synapse here that's learning needs to just know what is the activity in those synapses in the recent past. And that's all they need to know. Does that make sense? And then when I show you the mathematical statement, then you'll also see it from a slightly different angle. So should I go on to the next? Okay, so what is the learning rule? So let's define some terminology. So here's a neuron I in the performer network. All right, neuron I is receiving a reward from this evaluator, some signal, just a scalar global signal that all neurons receive, so it doesn't have an index. In addition, an index. In addition, neuron I is receiving synaptic input from neuron J through Sij, the synaptic variable. All right, and it's receiving an empiric input, Ci, from the empiric synapse that it receives. All right, and the one condition that must be satisfied is that the neuron, the total conductance of the neuron Cs is this kind of, is the sum over its inputs. So it's just all the synaptic inputs weighted by the weights plus the perturbation input, plus the, yeah. Yes, okay, so Sij, okay, so Sij is the input from neuron J to neuron I. It's a synaptic input. I'm sorry, Sij is time dependent because... Oh, it should be. I just said I miswrote. It should have been Sij. I just missed an index. Because it could be... Oh, no. Right, because, for example, the different synapses could be stochastic. They could have history dependent. So if the neuron spikes, then the different outputs from it, some of them may have a vesicle release, some of them may not. So to be perfectly general, there's no reason to assume that Sij is Sj. You can have it be Sij. So that's why, yeah. Okay, this is the one requirement that we have for the network. The other requirement is that if you introduce enough variables, then the dynamics should be Markov. All right, and then this is the following statement. So an R, the reward, is some functional, any functional you please, of the activities of the neurons in the network. All right, so then this is the learning rule. The change delta Wij in the weights is eta, a small learning parameter, times the global reward, this R, which all neurons in the network receive, and then times a local eligibility trace, Eij, which tags each synapse as being eligible for change or not. All right, and so what is this eligibility trace? This eligibility trace for each synapse is the following. It depends on the empiric input minus the average empiric input times the synaptic activation in that synapse. So every synapse has to remember what its activation was, but also has to know what the empiric input was minus the average empiric input. And that's the eligibility trace. All right, so if the learning rule is the following, that reward times local eligibility, then the statement is the following. This learning rule is actually performing gradient ascent on the reward function. So it's optimizing, it's hill climbing on the reward. So the expected change in weight when you average over all noises and all the perturbations is in the direction of the gradient of the expected reward. Proportional times the factor that doesn't depend on Ij, yes. That's right. So some constant times that. I'm sorry? Oh, can you relate the size here to eta? Eta comes in, eta is a linear multiple here, but the overall size you don't know because it depends on, transfer between, W and R. So yes, you can't. Not in a non-trivial example.
And that eligibility, the average eligibility is average over some period of time.
That's correct. Over some window.
To remember, but short enough so you can change.
That's correct, exactly. So as I've written it, it's in this batch update case where you run something, some dynamics from over some interval from 0 to big T, and then you make the change at the end of big T, that change. But you could make it a moving window. So there's an online version of this, which I haven't written down, but which is more biological anyway, which is that you just make this EIJ a running average, a boxcar running average, for example, of the last recent activities, and that's what you use.
Oh, they select
data. Oh, well, as in all gradient learning problems, there's no a priori way to choose a good eta. You have to choose one eta that's small enough. It always has to be small enough, otherwise it won't converge. But you always run the problem of having eta be chosen too small, so it'll be very slow. So it's a challenge. I mean, so presumably there could be another learning algorithm that actually learns eta. But what I do when I do simulations in this learning rule is I pick a small eta so that it converges, and then I increase it until it converges no more, and I find the fastest curve, and then I use that. Yes, actually, yeah. Actually, so I'd be happy to actually give a whole proof to anyone who's interested after, but I can give some comments. In fact, in the next slide, I was going to give you some intuition for why this gradient statement is true. But if you want to know, is your question sort of what are these averages? Okay, so let me give you an example of variables, and then I can tell you a little bit, and then after the talk we can even go through the whole proofs, yeah? So it assumes that the expectation of R is differentiable in W, not that R is.
Capital B up there is what?
The noise average, which is very different, right? Because R can be a step function of W, but if you add in noise, so if R itself has some small noises in it. So if you just, it's basically smoothing with the kernel, right? You take R and if you compute the expectation and compute the gradient. You integrate by parts, which is effectively you take the derivative of the distribution. But so the statement is that it's not R that has to be differentiable with W, but expectation of R. But once again, we can.
What is the V right above where it says local eligibility?
Yes, okay, so that's right. So there I was just pointing out that R is a functional of the activities in the network. And in this example, I'm going to just say V are the voltages of all the neurons in the network. It's a vector in time and in space of all the neurons, of all the activities of all the neurons over some time period. That's right, and it's a functional. So you choose, user defined. You choose something, and the statement is this learning rule will optimize that. Local optimum, yeah.
What was the thinking behind making an R a functional of the activity of the network?
Oh, because.
I think of it as expensive. I mean, I realize, of course, any expensive input.
Yeah, it will depend on the. That's correct, yeah, that's
but
all.
The right pattern in the network, then that gets your reward.
That's right. I mean, you're right. I mean, it needn't be right. I mean, I could have R be a functional. As I'll show you in this example of Birdsong, it's not actually a V. Okay. But you'll see in a later example that actually I take the network outputs, transform them, make them into motor coordinates, do all this stuff, and then R is a functional of that. So, all right. So okay. Now here's an example. All right. So this learning rule I just told you is for networks, but I didn't tell you what kind of network. So the only condition on the network that I told you must be satisfied for the statement to hold is that each neuron must sum its inputs in this way, and then compute its activity based on that. So here's an example of a network that does that. It's a full spiking network. This could be Hodgkin-Huxley neurons, integrating fire neurons, whatever you please. So if the voltages of neurons are given by just a simple capacitive equation, where the inputs are synaptic currents times the reversal potential for the synaptic currents, and ionic conductances for the spiking mechanisms, for leaks, and so on, times the reversal potentials for the various ions. All right, and then GI must be given by this relationship here, which is each neuron, the synaptic conductance is the sum of the conductances from all neurons in the network plus the empiric input. And Sij, which is the synaptic activation variable that someone wondered about earlier, is the following. It's some function, and it could be actually, this could be non-Markov, and it could be a function of many noise variables and so on, of the voltages in the past of the neuron J, as well as the past synaptic activation of that synapse, plus other variables. For example, if you're familiar with the Sodic's model of synaptic vesicle depletion and depression and so on, so it could have that, it could have variables that allow for short-term depression and facilitation and other dynamics. So this, in this network, you can implement that learning rule and it'll perform stochastic gradient ascent on the expected reward. Okay, so why was that learning rule working, right? What is the intuition? So you might think that the rule to change a synapse should be very simple. It should be reward correlated with activity in that synapse. If a synapse can compute its own correlation with reward, what more do you need, right? So why isn't Wij, the delta Wij, equal to the correlation between reward and synaptic activity? That's the basic quantity, right? So the point is that this learning rule is very close to that correlation with a little twist. So that equation up there is not adequate for the following reasons. So reward is a non-negative quantity. For example, it could be just, you know, a reward and not a reward. So it's like 0 or 1 or something like that. Synaptic activation is also a non-zero quantity, right? It's 0 or active. And just because a neuron, a synapse may just be active a lot of the time, and reward may be occurring part of the time, so there's spurious correlations there just by virtue of both of them being non-zero and positive. Ah, but that's okay. So I'm telling you why this is not adequate, and I'll tell you what the real solution is, and then you can discuss other forms. But okay, so that's why that's not adequate. There's spurious correlations that'll drive you. So instead, what do you want to do? I told you what we want to do is we want to make delta Wij in the direction of this gradient, right? So let's compute that gradient. So we want delta Wij to be this. But actually, because of this relationship I told you about, that G sums its inputs through this relation, right? Any derivative with respect to Wij is the same as the derivative with respect to some other input, some neural input like C or B, right? This is some bias and this is the empiric input. It's the same as the derivative with respect to B times Sij. This is just chain rule, right? So DDWij is the same as DDBI times Sij. All right, this is really hand waving, but I'm just telling you sort of the intuition. So that means this thing is like taking, so that means the gradient is actually like that quantity we wanted, this correlation between reward times synaptic activity, but it also has a derivative with respect to the postsynaptic neural bias. All right, so intuitively, this quantity here is taking away spurious correlations from that and converting the correlation into a covariance, or causation if you want. So it's saying, well, if there are these correlations, but I also have to vary how responsive the postsynaptic neuron is to how sensitive is this correlation to changes in the postsynaptic responsiveness to the inputs, and then learning is in the direction of the gradient. So this is the crux of why you don't use that, and why our learning rule looks like this. Okay, so one more step. Why does our learning rule look like this, right? So our learning rule is really close because our learning rule is reward times synaptic activity of the input times, it was Xi minus expectation of Xi, right? But you can, this derivative is like taking a correlation between RS and perturbations in Bi, which is Xi. So intuitively you can sort of see how, you know, the math would arise. So that's what I have to say about that. So the statement is that the learning rule is performing stochastic gradient ascent as doing optimization, but only on average, which is individual synapses in a trial may change in the wrong direction, but on average the performance gets better. All right, and yes, yes.
So presumably what you want up there on the top is, I don't see that it matters that reward is positive all the time and S is positive all the time, because presumably you want to strengthen things when they're correlated, when the correlation exceeds the average. And the average could be, you know, positive or negative.
Okay, so your intuition is really good, because actually it's really important that you do that for when you actually do learning simulations. Doing subtraction of a baseline of reward really helps you speed up learning. But mathematically, if you do, so imagine having R minus R0, right? But the point is that if inside the correlation, so suppose we do R minus R0, parenthesis, times Sij, all right? So, but the point is that R0 doesn't correlate. So if the learning rule is R minus R0 times Sij, but the point is that R0 doesn't correlate with Sij because it's in the past, right? So inside the correlation, that's zero.
So,
yeah, okay, so you can do these variations, but that's not the gradient, right? Okay, that's so that's a different learning rule. So there's a separate learning rule which Sebastian has published a paper on, and that's called, so this learning rule you can think of as a node perturbation, where you take a neuron and you perturb its activity and you correlate, you decide how does a neural change translate into synaptic change. There's another version where the noisy elements are the synapses themselves. So then you correlate how does fluctuations in a synapse correlate with reward and use that to update that same synapse. So R times delta Sij will be this sort of weight perturbation. And this rule is analogous to node perturbation in a network. And there's some important differences between the two learning rules, and I can point them out at the end. But one of them is speed. So node perturbation is significantly faster than weight perturbation in many learning problems. And there's... No, they can both do the same thing. I mean, representationally, there's no difference between them.
But
no, the optimal speed with node perturbation is much faster than optimal speed with weight perturbation in any given in a problem. Oh, if all the synaptic perturbations are correlated, it's exactly the same as node perturbation. But there's no way to do that. I mean, it's theoretically identical then. It's equivalent. So I can show you the theoretical reduction from synaptic weight perturbation to node perturbation. They're mathematically the same.
One is slower, but sound a little more powerful, I guess.
No, they're not. They're identical. Representationally, they're both exactly the same. So any task that weight perturbation can do, node perturbation can do, and vice versa. And so, I mean, these are all, mathematical statements. So, but then it's a question, the difference is a difference in learning time. And also, you can do baseline subtractions of reward, and they're very, very important for learning speed. But so they come, so baseline subtraction affects your second moment in your learning, and that affects the speed, but it doesn't affect the mean statement, which is that you're doing hill climbing. So, but you're absolutely right, like there are heuristic ways to make things much, much faster, and you would want to do reward baseline subtraction. But that's not sufficient to do gradient learning. So you need this derivative with respect to B, which is, you need this term in the learning rule, which is C minus expectation of C times reward. All right, so, so the first statement was that the optimization is only on average, so it's a stochastic optimization that's a slow process. And the second statement is actually that learning, the powerful thing is that the learning is completely model free. So like... Well, you have this one requirement on the network.
It has to be curly into the, what's K is.
Eta?
Eta.
No, it's a fixed, a small quantity.
So
for any fixed...
You get a very, very variable with spiky landscape.
Yeah.
Then you will have to get much smaller eta than to facilitate convergence, to have convergence.
Yeah.
Then if the landscape is actually smooth. So you do have dependence on the smoothness of the landscape through the value of eta.
Yeah, but the theoretical statement doesn't say what eta is. It says for some eta, the theoretical statement is if delta Wij is eta times R times Eij, you can find some eta, small, if you choose a small enough eta, then learning is along the gradient of the reward, right? So that's correct. That will work for all problems. That's correct. Yeah. That's right, that's right. Okay, so, but what I mean by model free is the learning rule, the form of the learning rule does not depend on what learning problem you have. It doesn't depend on the architecture of the network. It doesn't depend on how the neurons are contributing to reward. And the nice thing is it doesn't depend on, say, the model of spiking of the neuron. It doesn't, because as I showed you, the dynamics can be integrate and fire. The synapses can be facilitating or depressing. They can, it can be Hodgkin-Huxley neurons. It can be, yeah, something pretty complicated. So the other thing that's important to note is that the learning rule is absolutely local to synapses, aside from this very global signal, which is the evaluation. So you don't need kinds of structures like backprop and stuff like that, where you need information about the whole model, the whole spiking. You need the whole spiking transfer function. You don't need any of that. Also, the learning rule can deal with, like all reinforcement rules, it can deal with delayed reward, so delayed evaluation and dynamic synapses. So the main problem, though, is slow. How slow? Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. So the statement is okay. So first of all, as I've formulated the learning, yeah. That's right. Okay. So first, okay, you're right. So the first point is that as I've presented the learning rule in this talk, it's only for excitatory network. But the generalization to excitatory and inhibitory synapses is very simple. It's just an overall minus sign in the front, based on whether that neuron is excitatory or inhibitory. So that generalization is very straightforward. You can show that. And the statement is that then, if you make that one generalization, then in a network which has both inhibitory and excitatory synapses, as long as each synapse follows this learning rule, that network will, up to its representational capacity, optimize the reward function. Okay, so the main problem then, the virtues of the learning rule may also be its weakness. So the beauty of the learning rule, the reason why it's relatively model-free, is that each synapse doesn't need to know anything. It just makes it makes a guess, and then it correlates how well it did. You know, each neuron figures out how well that guess led it to do, and just by checking the correlation, it decides how to change, right? But this is a really slow process. It's like having a box with many, many dials, and changing each one, and looking to see how the output changes, and doing each one at a time. So potentially this could be a painfully slow process. And question is, how does it generalize? How does it generalize to a large network? And is it even feasible for brain size large networks? So the question is then that individual correlations, if you have a large network, then the correlations of an individual neuron with the outcome are very small, right? Because they contribute in a very small way to the overall outcome. So do you need very long averaging? And the only way we can really answer that question is to really apply it to a biological example, which is what brings me to birdsong learning. This work is with Sebastian Tseng and Michael Fee. And I just wanted to point out that birds are these, ideal systems to study in, because we know the behavior, right? We can quantify how well they're doing. We know what the task is that they have to learn. They're supposed to imitate their father's song, and by the end of some period, they actually can. So you know what the goal is, you can quantify it, and people have done these pretty beautiful experiments measuring activity in the nuclei that drive song while the bird is singing. And it's a relatively small sequestered set of nuclei, so you can have a sense of what the dynamics are in the network. So zebra finches are like those birds. They only learn one song in their whole life. So they learn one song in the beginning, and they sing that same song for the rest of their lives. This is the behavior of birds. So that's an adult male zebra finch, and that's a baby. And what happens is learning seems to segment into these periods where in the beginning it's only sensory, so the bird's not making very many noises. It just listens to its father in the sensory period. And then there's a sensory motor period where then the bird starts to practice and improve its song. So in the beginning it's just squawking, and then its song gets better and better until it's actually producing a very faithful copy at the end here of the father's song, and then the song is set to crystallize, which is, it stops changing very much. I'm sorry?
All birds sing, the male sing only?
In all songbirds, only the male sing, but in different songbirds, this behavior is different, so the sensory and sensory motor periods are different, and also some birds are open learners, which is some songbirds will learn new songs throughout their whole life, like nightingales, for example, and mockingbirds, and so they don't just learn one song. I believe so, but I'm not sure in the talking birds. Like in parrots, I'm not sure if it's just the males or also the females. But in the songbirds, it's the males always. And okay, and other birds like canaries relearn their song every season, and then other birds learn new songs and so on. So this particular, you know, time window and so on is particularly zebra finch. All right, and so now. In experimental situations in the lab, what you can do is you can control the sensory period and shorten it so that the bird only has access to its father's song until here, and then it must, before it starts learning on its own, starts singing. And then when it starts singing, it receives absolutely no feedback from the father, no song from the father, no inputs from the father, and it's just stuck in a cage on its own, and then it actually learns the whole thing. So you can separate the sensory and sensory motor periods in lab. So the interesting thing that tells you is that social feedback is not important for it to learn, you know, once it starts singing, right? And the tutor song is not needed. So the bird is basically has already acquired some mental template of the father's song in the sensory period, and all it does is from its memory and some internal evaluator, it judges how well it's doing and improves its song. So auditory feedback of its own song is crucial, because if you deafen it during this period, it won't learn the father's song. So okay, so these two things tell you that, you know, it's listening to its own song and it's comparing it with an internal tutor. Where the evaluation signal lives in the brain, no one knows. So that's sort of experimentally unsolved question of what the evaluator is and where and what it's doing. So what is the song circuit? So this is the bird brain, and a significant part of its brain is actually involved in producing song. And it's color-coded, so these purple blue areas are here, and then the green areas are unfolded here. So let's look at the unfolded thing. So there's a motor pathway. So the blue areas are the motor pathway, and the green areas are this other pathway called anterior forebrain. So the motor pathway is called motor pathway for an obvious reason. So if you lesion any of the nuclei in the motor pathway, the bird stops singing completely, immediately. So it cannot produce song. So clearly those are important for driving motor. This other pathway, the anterior forebrain pathway that gets inputs from the motor pathway and then puts outputs into the motor pathway, is less clear cut in what it does. So if you lesion the anterior forebrain pathway completely in adults, the bird can still sing. It sings almost the same song. There's almost no change at all in the song. If you lesion it in the juvenile, then it's still learning how to sing. The song prematurely crystallizes. So the variability in the song stops. It doesn't learn anymore, but it also doesn't change what it had learned up till then. So it seems to sort of be stuck there, right? So our hypothesis, okay, so, well. I'm sorry?
In the female bird.
In the female bird, the volumes of HVC and ARIA are smaller. I don't know very much about the anterior forebrain pathway. The female bird has a few sounds that it makes. So they make distance calls. So they make like a little harmonic stack. They go coo, you know, or something like that. They have a set of a few calls, and I think they use some of the same machinery to make the calls, but they don't have this learned vocalization. So maybe it's a different degree than, you know, absolute. But so there's a difference in size of these areas, and then, but people, because it doesn't have the learned vocalization, people haven't measured, you know, single unit recordings while the bird is making the calls on the females, because it's just less interesting, I think. So I personally don't know of that much data on what's going on in the female brain.
The females still have to have the circuits to recognize when the male.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So they have a lot of the apparatus.
That's probably, yes, exactly.
So they can tell which male is which.
Yes, that's right.
Make preferences.
Yes, that's right. So and yeah, so people do a lot of these studies of, you know, what female preferences are in songs, and you know how much the female responds to songs, and there may be, as you say, you know, recordings of, you know, auditory areas in female, but I'm just not as familiar with the information. So, but good question. So, all right. So this area is crucial for motor. All right. So now let's look at one area that's interesting. So RA is this motor area here, this nexus that receives inputs from the motor pathway as well as from this other pathway. So let's, okay, so remembering that, let's look at what happens in HVC and RA and LMAN. So let me just show you a little bit of data. So this is data from Richard Hahnloser, Alex Kozevnikov, and Michael Fee from the Fee Lab. And they recorded in HVC, extracellular recordings of HVC neurons that project downstream in the motor pathway. And this is while the bird was awake and singing. And in the top, this is a spectrogram of the song. So this is the time axis, and that's the frequency axis, and this is intensity. So yellow scale is intensity, log intensity. And okay, so that's the bird as it's singing. This is just a raw sound trace of that same song, just plotted a different way. All right, and this is a song, and that's the call, you know, that the females also make and the males make. This is the call sound. And these are 10 different HVC neurons that are projecting down into RA. And they have this very, very simple looking activity, which is almost bizarre. So this whole scale here is about 1 second. And a single neuron here, this is raster plots. So these are repeated instances, the same color as repeated trials. The bird sings the same song again and again. And they just align to the song. So you see that a single neuron seems to only fire one time, and different neurons fire different times in the song. So it's a very simple sort of a time representation, like a sort of just a clock. So this neuron says, okay, we're at this part of the song. This neuron says, we're at this part of the song, and so on. You can see that, you know, I mean, just because a neuron is active when the song looks like something, you know, something here, it doesn't mean that when the song looks like that again, that neuron will fire again. It really seems to be a one, you know, just a one time, not a feature-based thing, but a time-based type of activity. So now RA, this downstream area that's receiving in the motor pathway, that's receiving input from HVC, looks, yeah. That was all the recorded HVC neurons. Yeah, this is every single HVC neuron they recorded. It's RA projecting. That's correct. And these are interneurons that don't project into RA. They're just, well, I don't really want to make any points about this, but it's just, these neurons are just firing all the time. It's some inhibition, global inhibition or something within HVC. But we're not going to model this. We're just going to treat this as an input to the system, as I'll tell you later. Okay, RA activity looks pretty different. So RA neurons seem to be summing their inputs from HVC. And remember, they also receive inputs from this other area, from this anterior forebrain pathway. So RA neurons, this is four different RA neurons, and this is four different trials for each one. So this is the song, aligned to the song. And you can see that RA activity seems to be a little bit more variable than HVC activity. Each neuron is active many more times. And you know, slightly different from HVC, but pretty reliable from trial to trial and song to song. And different neurons fire at different times. So what is sort of the model in our minds of how, you know, the motor pathway is working? What are the dynamics of the motor pathway? So the idea is the following. So HVC is an area that just generates a very sparse sequence in time, just a time sequence. And the way it does that is that there's some, you know, you could imagine, you know, something where, okay, so HVC neurons, neuron 1 fires at time 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So these are different HVC neurons, 1 through 5, firing at T1, T2, T3, T4, and T5. And these HVC neurons are projecting to RA, and the RA neurons are just summing their inputs from HVC. So for example, RA neuron A is active at time T1 and T4. So if you look at neuron A, it's active at T1 and T4, and so on. So it's just this feedforward thing, and learning here would be, if an HVC sequence is already present, then learning would be learning the appropriate feedforward rates from HVC to RA to produce the appropriate sounds at the appropriate times. So if you want to produce a certain sound at T1, then this neuron has to learn to project to the appropriate RA neurons that are driving motor activity downstream. Now the other piece of interesting evidence from the data is that LMAN activity is pretty variable. And it's especially variable when the bird does not sing to a female. So birds have these two modes when they're singing to a female, to tractor, but they also have this other mode where they're singing to, you know, just themselves, just to practice or something like that. And their song is more variable at that time, and so is LMAN activity. So this is just a raster plot again. You can see from repetition to repetition how much more variable LMAN is than RA or HVC in the song. So our conjecture is that RA is this nexus for synaptic change in the motor system. It's the performer. And LMAN, this area from the anterior forebrain pathway, its job is an empiric or experimental area that injects perturbations into the network to drive it to explore a small range of behaviors and help it learn. So the song system schematic is this. So you have a motor network, right, which is the whole bird song motor thing. It drives vocal apparatus, which produces song. LMAN is actually coming in here and empirically perturbing the motor network and driving variations in the song. And in addition, there's a separate auditory evaluation area in the brain that gives feedback to the motor network on how the song was. So that's our picture of the birdsong system. That's a schematic. And so here in slightly more detail is the model that we use. So we model HBC neurons and RA neurons, integrated and fire neurons. And it's a feed-forward structure, much like the birdsong structure. So they're feed-forward inputs from HBC to RA. LMAN projects to RA and perturbs RA activity. And LMAN neurons are just spiking neurons. They're Poisson spike trains. And these two units here represent motor pools. So we model two motor pools. One of the jobs of one of the motor pools is to control the pitch of the song at any instant. So the activity in the motor pool at that instant tells you what the pitch of the song should be. So it's like a muscle in the syrinx. The other motor pool controls the amplitude of the song. How loud should the song be? And our sound producing model here is actually just a very simple model from signal processing. It's source filter model, where you have a source, a harmonic source, with delta pulses spaced apart by the pitch, and with height, that's the amplitude. They're passed through a fixed filter, which mimics sort of the vocal tract of the bird to sort of shape the overall harmonic structure, and that produces a sound. Right? In addition, we have a recording of zebrafinch songs from actual zebrafinches, and we compare. So the evaluation signal will compare time by time of the student song with the tutor song and produce a single evaluation signal. Back. Yeah?
So you're basically actually directly going on HBC to the
motor. That's correct.
That's the reason
that it has to go to RA. Okay, we can guess some reasons, but that theoretically it's not clear why it goes to RA, why there's a fan out into RA.
In fact, actually, it's a simpler problem. You're asking
Well, it's equally simple, but it's simpler in the sense that you don't have to go through another nonlinearity. Yeah, it's not clear why the bird does this. I mean,
they have to do other motor things with the same motor out.
Yeah.
Complicated. They had to
relearn
the songs, and plus all the reflexes and things that are
right. That's right. So in animals that have more generalization ability, it makes sense to have a learning where you learn the primitives. See, zebrafinches. That's why I didn't want to say this answer that Chuck gave for zebrafinch, because they really do a very limited range of vocal behaviors, and they don't have a lot of generalization. But in other birds that do generalization, you would want to learn a motor map, like a primitive, which is, if I activate this set of RA neurons, this bundle, then it'll produce this small part of song. And then all I want to learn is then, in a higher area, I want to relearn like new trajectories, like new sequences, and feed onto them.
Well, they need breathing, too. I mean, these motor neurons are used for breathing.
That's true.
And that is a separate step. What? No, you have the same neurons they do. Maybe you can use them for breathing. See, all the animals have them for breathing.
How localized is the in time with the evaluation? The parsing underlying that.
Okay, great. I'm glad you asked. Okay, so what we do, so we assume, right, that evaluation has some time component, which is as the bird is singing, it doesn't just receive a signal at the very end. So it is an online thing, which is the bird hears throughout. So I can tell you how I do it. So we do the following. So what we do is we take a window in time, all right, so some window of, I think the width is about 15 milliseconds of song. In that window, we correlate, we compare the tutor and the student by extracting the pitch and the amplitude, for example. So we compute, we have some distance metric, and if they're if they're closer than some threshold, then we'd give a 1 in that time bin. And if it's further than a threshold, then we give a 0, right? Then what we do with the thing is we have this, then we have a trace of zeros and ones, right, as the evaluation.
With
the
fixed delta T.
With the fixed delta T, but we don't use that because it's quite fine-grained, as you point out, right? So what we do then, we low-pass filter that trace of zero and ones with a 50 millisecond low-pass filter. So it's, for example, if you have some fast auditory comparison and then you have some dopamine signal that's actually doing the signaling of how you did. So to mimic sort of the time course of these slow neuromodulators, we use a 50 millisecond thing. So we smear the whole thing out by 50 milliseconds. And in addition, we delay the reward by an other 50 milliseconds. So we do a 50 millisecond delay, 50 millisecond smear of this trace of zeros and ones that we would generate from time to time, like that, and use that. All right, so what are the results? I mean, that's what you want to know. Oh, right, okay, wait, before I do that. So here's just some sample traces. So that's two HVC neurons on the top. These are integrated fire neurons. So that's neuron 1, neuron 2, and these are driving. Here's a representative neuron 3, some neuron in RA. And this is what its trace looks like. This is somewhere in the middle of learning. And then, for example, I'm just showing you the amplitude, this motor pool. This is the amplitude here, the smooth curve. And then the wobbly curve is actually the amplitude of the tutor song. So I'm just showing you that in the process of learning, this is sort of what it's looking like. All right, so after learning, I'm just showing you just a zoomed in picture of, you know, one small component of the song. So here is the tutor song. All right, so this is one syllable in the tutor song. It's this chirped sound. This is what we start out with. We start the whole network in such a way that the drive is basically just some mean. The bird has some natural pitch at which it sings, and we just pushed air through. So we just start at some natural pitch, and then you see these modulations, these small ripples, are due to the perturbations from L-man. So that's the sort of the scale at which there's noise. And there's also no structure in the amplitude structure of the song, because you can see that the relative red scale intensity is the same throughout the whole thing. So there's no amplitude modulation, there's no frequency modulation, there's just little perturbations. This is the tutor, and after, I think this is 2,000 epochs of learning, you get this. So you start seeing amplitude modulation here, because it's much less intense here, and over here, because it's blue, and then and the amplitude is peaked around here, and you also get this frequency modulation. So if you want to hear what it sounds like, we have that, right, because we're doing actually songs, so we're comparing the actual sounds. So let me first play you the tutor song. There we go. It's exactly what it is. No. So this is what you would hear from these. These zebrafinch make hideous sounds. It's just.
No, that's the sound of the
floor. It's sampled at exactly the. This is only a small clip of the song, right? So this is only 300 milliseconds of a song that actually lasts a second, and then it repeats.
It's kind of scratchy.
It's very scratchy. Yeah, as you can see, this is this one. So you can see I've only taken the. So zebrafinch have also these noisy parts. So these are the harmonic syllables, but they also have these syllables that look like noise, basically. And I haven't modeled those. And you can easily, because we had to then include a noise thing into our source for the model. So that's why I've taken sort of a harmonic piece of the song and done it. So yeah, so okay, so just, are you used to hearing this now? Should I play it a few more times? Okay, and this is what I start out with in the beginning. This model, this is what it's, right. Just constant with some noise. Okay, at the end of 2,000 epochs of learning, it'll still learn some more and do better, but here. Compared to the tutor. So it's getting the harmonic and the amplitude structure right. It's more hissy because it still has some perturbations on it. I haven't sent the L-man inputs to zero yet, and it could still do some learning. So some more to improve. But so that's sort of the output. So this is what you can learn. And this was a network with 200 HVC neurons, 800 spiking integrated fire RA neurons, and two motor output pools. The bird has eight individual muscles that it controls for its vocalization. This is for the syrinx. We just do two. But also we have a fixed filter, the sort of the vocal tract filter that we use for the whole harmonic envelope, some of those muscles may be involved in modulating that. So that's basically, we just use a fixed filter for the whole song. Yeah. But it's amazing that you can do pretty well, right, with just doing two, even though the bird has this complex thing. But maybe the bird hears much more than we do, too. Oh, it's just. Ah, so theoretically. Theoretically, there's no difference, right? Because our learning rule works for integrating for Hodgkin-Huxley model. What would really, the reason why we don't do it is because the simulation time is longer, not the number of epochs in learning, but each pass, each learning pass, you have to, you know, simulate all these currents and stuff like that. So it's just slower. I don't think it should be very different because why? I mean, you're basically just driving in a convergent way. You're just summing all the outputs of these neurons, and you actually low pass filter because the synaptic currents are not the spikes, right? The synaptic currents are the low pass filter. These alpha functions are the spikes. So, I mean, Hodgkin-Huxley neurons are different in their spike width, right? And yeah. But my intuition from working with these models tells me that there's not going to be much difference, especially since the output we're using is this low-pass filtered. Yeah. Yeah, I'm, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Will be essentially the same. Yeah, that's absolutely my intuition. Yeah, that's the only thing that matters is your summed motor output. That's what's producing the song. It doesn't depend in any, if my task depended in some crucial way on the spiking and the shape and so on, then it would make a difference. But I really don't see it entering in. But yeah.
Okay, so in this space, there's really one attractor that you're trying to find, is that right? And it's really the question of how efficient, or one fixed, I mean, you're trying to find one, some minimum somehow.
Yeah, a solution, but in this problem there may be actually many solutions because, as I'll talk about later, it's a pretty redundant problem. Okay, but...
Sorry, you're saying there may be many ways to get to the same point.
Yeah. No, I'm saying there are actually many, if you look at the space, the weight space W, there may be many solutions, there may not be a unique solution W star that gives the answer. There may be many configurations, there may be a whole plane of solutions or something like that. It's a very multidimensional space, right? It's very large dimensional. It's 200 times 800 weights.
So I'm trying to get the intuition as to why, if you change some aspects of the problem, you don't end up in a different, you don't end up with a very radically different solution.
No, you do in the weight space. So depending on, you know, I initialize my weights.
In the output, not in the weight space.
Oh, because I told you, my learning rule is guaranteed to optimize my reward. And since my reward is how far is the student from the tutor, it's going to drive me to a solution where I'm to an optimum of the... So, okay, because I'm doing it on the song traces. So I take the sound file, right, which is this, you know, this time-varying trace, this of sound, and I compute a autocorrelation to extract pitch within the trace. And then, so I get a P of T, which is pitch in time, and A of T, which is amplitude in time. So I subtract so I compute the same thing for both the tutor song and the student song. I take the difference between the pitch and the amplitude of each, square them, and sum them. And that's my metric. I mean, people don't do birdsong processing that I know of very much. Yeah, in speech recognition, they do something similar. Yeah. Oh, if I did it?
Yeah, everything, you know, 2,000 epochs, you were just saying whether you got closer or farther away.
You mean instead of doing the signal processing thing, I just about each song, I just say if it's closer or further?
The question would be whether the amplitude song would be closer as we hear it. Now you were using one particular metric to converge to the solution.
Oh. Well. No, because I only generate the sound using those two those two signals anyway. The song is no more multidimensional than my metric for it, actually, because I'm just, the only things I have control over are my amplitude and my pitch, right? So that's the only thing I have control over, and I tell you how close those are to the tutor amplitude and pitch. So if I had a more complex sound model, then if I only use amplitude and pitch, I might have been doing worse because I'm not comparing all the other features. But since my sound generating model is already so low dimensional, and I'm computing error along all those dimensions, so I can't do any better. But there's also, you know, so any differences that you hear between these two, part of it is also because we're using a very simple sound model. So even if our learning rule is doing the perfect job, it's only going to learn as well as my sound model can replicate the bird song, right? So,
presumably the real thing would be a lower dimensional model, would be a lower dimensional problem than one you have, because you probably assume that everything in HPC connected to everything in RA, but that's probably not true. There are probably patterns of connections, so that you can't get any possible combination of activities. There are only certain ones that are possible that are
right. I mean, anything over and above, if you assume anything special about the structure, you can probably just improve your learning time just because you have all this other prior stuff that you've put in.
It's really unreasonable to think that any one brain area connects to every other.
Yeah, that's right. So what we're trying to do is really, so in the next one, I'll talk about how, you know, we scale up. This is 2000 epic, so how would it scale up in a large bird song? So what we're trying to do is just a proof of principle, making just the most boneheaded assumptions. How much time would it take? And then anything on top of that would improve, right? It would help you learn faster. So, but we don't want to start out arguing that, because then it wouldn't be a sort of upper bound in how long it would take to learn. But I agree.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that because if you just look at the spectrogram,
yeah,
it sounds kind of good, but it doesn't really look very good.
Yeah. Oh,
and presumably,
oh, you think it actually sounds better than it looks?
Yeah.
Really?
I couldn't tell the difference.
Really? Oh.
Well, you heard a lot of times. That was
yeah, okay. To me, I hear a lot of difference. Let's do it once more before we move on to the next slide, but yeah.
But presumably, it would
yeah.
be a lot faster. And
that's right.
Part of that structure, some of the stuff in the spectrogram is kind of probably a result of the mapping rules.
Yes. Well, also the other things that make this look crummy are sort of, first of all, I don't filter, you know, maybe the motor plant filters the noise and smooths out, you know, variations, so they're not very big. I don't put in a very long time constant for my motor plant. The other things that to note are that this is after 2,000 epochs of learning, I just arbitrary, the learning curve just goes on and on, decreasing very slowly. And so at some point, I just get impatient and I say, okay, this is it. But note that the bird practices for 80,000 to 100,000 iterations over the course of learning. So if I ran this algorithm for 80,000 epochs, it could probably look awfully close.
Just,
yeah, but
weeks.
Yeah.
They sang a few hundred times a day.
That's right, which is what they do. They sing actually a few thousand times a day.
What's their starting spectrum
like? It is. It's, well, no, it's. I mean, it. They have. So they. So there's two things, right? There's like the syllables, there's like blocking sound into like temporal episodes, like, you know, like a syllable structure, and then refining the what you make in the syllable. But if you actually hear the song in the beginning, it is really bad to hear. It's noisy like this. If I can show you some spectrograms later. It's noisy. It doesn't have much structure, so the syllables are pretty long and they get shorter.
But it has a lot more structure actually than what.
That's right. So once again, we're trying to do the most minimal thing. We're really trying to do a proof of principle. We're trying to assume the least and get a time. Yeah.
More structure at least, like, you know,
yeah.
Shifting, cutting, things like that. Not like just the mindless screen, descending.
Oh.
Shifting structure.
So
how would you explain that?
Okay. Well, that is and isn't true. So. In the temporal domain, what the bird does is it has a song, right? So the juvenile, so the bird song lasts about a second. So really, like if you look at, let's just go here. So like this song, this is actually 300 milliseconds of it, but the song actually would be like this long. It would be a second of unique, you know, arrangement, and then it would just repeat the song over and over again in the adult. Right? If you look at the juvenile, what it does is it sings for 1 second, which is the whole duration, and it's just some garbled stuff. And then over time, it in situ, it learns each syllable better and better. So first of all, it looks like it is learning, like in time, it's in situ. So it starts here, and just as you see here, it sort of carves out each piece and inserts a stop, starts to make that frequency go higher, and lower. So in the space, in the temporal sense, it looks to be really a stupid sort of gradient learning. Now, in the frequency sense, it may be more subtle, right? Because in this paper of Partha Mitra and Ofer Chernyshevsky, they see that what the bird does sometimes is, suppose this harmonic stack here is at 1400 hertz. And the bird starts out singing at 1100 hertz. What sometimes it'll do is it'll go, or no, let's say it starts singing at 900 hertz. It'll go down to 700 hertz and then do frequency doubling to go up to 1400. So it'll go down gradually in a gradient way and then suddenly frequency double. All right, so you might say, well, that doesn't look like gradient learning, right? Because it's a sudden transition. It actually seems to go the wrong way because it goes from 1000 to 700 and then doubles rather than going 1000 to 1400 directly. But that's a question of what metric you use, because in a perceptual metric for humans, sounds that are half apart in frequency are actually much more dissimilar than how sounds that you think of as like one whole octave apart in frequency. So in that metric, you know, first of all, going down towards 700 is actually going in the right direction. And then frequency doubling is not as abrupt as you might think, because actually the bird has, when it sings, it combines harmonics at all levels. So if you match, then there's a lot of overlap between the harmonic and its double frequency of the period. So there's not that. No, not in zebrafinch. In other animals, in other birds maybe. But that's the nice thing about zebrafinch. It's very simple. But all, I think all the points that you guys are making are that it's not just gradient. This higher order structure in there, and the bird, you know, uses it, like, you know, maybe in choice of HVC projections to RA, maybe in, you know, sort of its perceptual thing and so on. But the point is that these are all things that are higher on. But ultimately, you do have to solve the question of, given some metric and distance, how does the synapses learn? So we're sort of just doing the really boneheaded thing. I'm not saying that this is the complete model of birdsong learning, but it gets you quite far. And then you have to put things on top. But the question is, how much, remember, we're doing this to find out how much learning time it would take in an example, right? So let's get to the scaling things, and then we can discuss more about the structure. So that network was kind of big, you know, for our simulation standards. It was 200 by 800 by 2, all integrated in fire neurons, so a lot of synapses and so on. But obviously, that's very much smaller than the bird, right? So question is, does the correlation, so a correlation of a single neuron, any single, like say an RA neuron with the reward is like 1 over n, where n is the number of RA neurons, for example, or something. So is the learning time, therefore, you know, do you have to average that signal n times to compute a correlation of yourself with reward to order 1? So do you need to average n times? And so just to give you an example of what would happen if actually learning time did scale like n, is the following consideration. So there are actually a factor of 4,000 more neurons in the bird than in my simulation. And my simulation took 2,000 epochs to convert, so that would be 8 million practice iterations. And although the bird does a lot, it does 100,000 iterations, that's nowhere close to 8 million. So, okay, that's looking pretty bleak. Right, so this is the question, right? So this is the question is...
It's not a question of scaling because you have nodes. It's a question of there is a fixed value of noise in each neuron, which is just kind of from particular from molecular structure of this neuron.
Yeah.
And 1 over n can be possibly comparable to that.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you're looking... Yeah, but if you're looking at, but okay, so the question of how much noise in a neural activity, in a single neuron activity comes from molecular noise versus the noise from the empiric input, right? This is a single neuron question you're asking, because, right? So that's not going to change whether it's a small network or a large network.
No,
my point...
But the relation of that neuron with the reward we talked
Yeah. That's correct, that's right. So if you have, yes. That's right. That's right. So if you have a lot of other sources of noise, you know, uncorrelated noise with the reward, but they're going to slow down learning because you have all this fluctuation. So. That's right. So, okay, that's exactly right. So, okay, so once again, right. So once again, this stochastic gradient learning shouldn't be interpreted as a learning theory for the whole brain, you know, that we can optimize sort of the world just with this one gradient rule and nothing else. Rather, it should be thought of as like in modules of the brain, so small areas of the brain, for example, these song areas, given a reward signal, can you compute some correlations with the evaluation? So, and then if the brain has specific tasks to do, like suppose this birdsong area is sequestered to do birdsong, then as you asked earlier, the noise inputs may be correlated, right? So the theory was for, you know, one network doing arbitrary numbers of tasks. But if you have one area just doing one task, and if your noises are correlated, like these experimental empirical inputs, that'll allow this, the variation from the empiric inputs to rise above this uncorrelated noise. So okay, I agree that if you have a very large network, you have to think about different strategies. It's a very interesting research question is how to really generalize this to very large networks. And then you really do need correlated empiric inputs and things like that. But I mean, I'm really trying to ask, in a single module with a reward signal, how big a network can you have, okay, without these other considerations where you can learn? So that's why I'm using just this birdsong example to be very specific. But you're right, it's not a theory of learning in the whole brain. This it can't be, it'll be too slow. But how slow, right? So okay, so does it scale like n or not? So okay, so this is the question. So the answer, if I can tell you, we get in two parts. So we can, because the network is this nice feedforward structure, we can actually, if we linearize all the activities of the neuron, we can analytically compute the learning curves. So we can take our learning rule, apply it to a linear network where the transfer functions of neurons instead of being integrated and firing neurons are linear, and we can compute how learning time would depend on the number of RA neurons, on the number of input neurons, and the number of outputs, and so on. Okay, so here, we did this analytical calculation, but I'm not going to show you that. I'm going to show you just the numerical simulations on a linear network and our analytical curve. So this is a plot of error as a function of iteration number, and the iteration number is actually divided by n output plus 2, but let me just explain what these things are. So we have the following network. We have a network with one hidden layer, so input layer, hidden layer, and outputs. And the goal of the network is to learn to make the outputs match a desired set of outputs for many input patterns. So for all the input patterns, the outputs has to match the desired outputs. And we use a learning rule. And what we do is we do the learning curves when varying the number of units in the hidden layer and the number of units in the output layer. So if we first look at the solid line, the solid lines represent learning curves for that network if the hidden layer is of size 20, 200, or 2,000. All right, and so 20 is magenta, 200 is blue, and 2,000 is red. So these are the learning curves for that many hidden units. And the black curve is the theory curve that we compute analytically. And you see that learning time actually does not scale at all with the number of units in the hidden layer, even though the hidden layer neurons are the ones that are receiving the perturbations. So that the number of hidden layer neurons tells you how many independent noises you're putting into the network. So it doesn't depend on the number of independent noises. I'm sorry? Oh, here? Oh, this depends on your learning rate eta. It also depends on, yeah, the variance of the input noise and so on, yeah. So, and the size of the network. Okay, so the interesting thing is, okay, so why? Why does the learning not depend on number of hidden units and number of independent noises you put into the network? So the answer is that actually the correlation of individual neurons, RA neurons, with reward doesn't matter. because they're not individually playing a role in driving the reward. They all pool their outputs into the output units, and the outputs are the ones driving the reward. So the only thing that matters is not how individual neurons work, but how their pooled output changes. And if they're pooled, so now let's look at how what happens when you vary the number of output units. So the number of output units is 2, 5, and 10, I vary it to be, and they're all the blue curves. So the solid blue curve is 2 output units. The dashed one is 5, and the dot dashed one is 10. And notice that the learning time is scaled like 1 over n over n, over 2. So actually, these curves take longer and longer in proportion to the number of outputs to learn. So the learning task, so what the learning time does scale like the number of output units, because the complexity of the task is equal to how many outputs you have to learn. So if the output is a very high dimensional space, then it's a hard task. You have to learn all these intricate things, and learning is slower, but it doesn't depend on the number of neurons in the hidden layer. So
what is that the learning rate as organic is pretty much under all those
curves? No, I'm sorry, I've rescaled this axis for these learning curves for the blue ones only.
Oh,
I've rescaled it by the number of output units over 2. That's right. So actually, if I just plotted them on an absolute number of iterations, it would be, you know, take a factor of 2.5 longer from 2 to 5, and then factor of 2 longer from 5 to 10. That's right. And I won't talk about the cyan curve. That's actually a different thing, so I'm not going to discuss that. So okay, so that's the point. So the point is that actually the number of independent noises you put in doesn't matter, and the number of and these are the optimal learning curves for all these situations, by the way. So the best learning time for that number of neurons. So how does it transfer? Does it transfer to the nonlinear network at all? Because we've done this very simple linear analysis. So this is the whole birdsong network I showed you earlier with the integrated fire neurons and the sound comparison. And I'm only running it on 75 milliseconds of song, like a small piece, just because it takes too long for me in my simulations to run it. And the blue curve is actually with 200 RA neurons in this hidden layer, the neurons that receive the perturbations. And this is the best learning curve I could get. I empirically optimized it. I empirically optimized my ADA, my learning speed, to get the fastest learning possible. Right? Then I take the RA layer and make it 800 neurons big, so a factor of 4. And what I do with that is I rescale all the parameters according to my linear theory. And I adjust my noise down and so on. And then I also just empirically optimize the red curve. And the red curve is no slower than the blue curve. Right? So that means learning with so scaling the number of RA neurons in this nonlinear simulation also doesn't really affect the number of iterations it takes to learn. So this tells me, okay, so now what's the difference then between my model simulations and the actual bird? So a big difference was in the number of RA units I used. And the number of outputs is actually the number of motor pools, the number of independent controls the bird has on the song. And I used 2, the bird has 8, so that's a factor of 4. Okay, and it also turns out that for these unary inputs, the kind of HVC inputs that you see, learning time doesn't depend on the length of song or in the number of HVC units. So actually the prediction from the linear analysis and the simulations is that learning in a network the size of a birdsong network, if I did that in my model, it would only take a factor of 4 more epochs to learn. So instead of 2,000, it would take 8,000 to 10,000 iterations. So the real moral of the story is that it's actually not scaling like n, the size of the whole network, but it's a question of redundancy and rank of the problem. So it's actually correlation of single outputs with reward, and time to learn scales not as the network size, but as the size of the complexity in this model. That's just NO, and so that's the learning time. And so what are the take-home principles, right? So, I mean, as Ilya is pointing out, you know, even though I can do it for this birdsong example, this is not a theory of the brain. So only simple tasks, sort of, quote-unquote, can be learned using this kind of gradient algorithm. And learning time is independent of network size in redundant networks. But also note that actually motor control, learning of motor control, fine motor control, is slow. Right, like birds practice 80,000 times this one song, just the second long of song. And to practice tennis or anything else, it also takes a lot of effort, many, many trials or a swim stroke. So motor control can be slow. And it's also a very redundant problem where you have many neurons in motor cortex controlling relatively few muscles and so on. And so, and I think that's my last slide. Yeah, so my last slide is just if as an experimentalist you're interested in the learning rule and are curious how to test learning, how to test whether a region of the brain does this kind of learning, then you have to do the following things. You have to identify a network in blue, which is the performer network, which is the network where you think that you think is driving behavior, that you think is learning. You have to identify an area that projects to this area that seems to be putting in perturbations, and you have to identify the evaluators. You have to evaluate the three brain areas. And you need to have control, or you need to be able to stimulate overall extracellularly some big stimulation of the evaluator and the experimenter. And in addition, you need to be able to patch clamp onto the two of your neurons, your two connected neurons in your performer. So this is what you would need anyway for an STDP or LTP paradigm, right? You just patch clamp onto a pre and post neuron. And all you need then is like some extracellular sort of stimulation of these two extra areas. And then what do you want to look for? You want to every time neuron J, this presynaptic neuron, is active, you want to stimulate, if you stimulate your experimenter and your evaluator every time that's active, then you should see a growth in this synaptic strength. That weight should increase. On the other hand, if you see activity here and all you do is just stimulate the evaluator, then you should actually be able to decrease the synaptic weight. So this is sort of what, this is a way to probe whether this learning wheel exists in the brain. So finally, this learning wheel is attractive because it, you know, tells you something about why maybe the brain is so noisy and how noise might actually not be just only a detriment, but also useful in learning.
That's actually
the kind of way you're... That's correct, that's right. So cortex, or parts of the brain. Why are parts of the brain noisy?
Yeah.
Visual cortex seems to be very noisy.
That's true.
True.